Okay, welcome back.
This is Jeff Sachs from Web Yeshiva and Mishkan Sipora in Efrat. We're learning Masechet Ta'anit. Tonight, our learning is Le'ilui Nishmat Reb Yisrael ben Pesach Zal, the father of our Chaver Tzvi Maizel. So Tzvi, say us a word about your father, Zichron Olevracha. You have to unmute. Wait, Tzvi, you're muted.
I'm now.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. He was a very, listen, I'm his son, so I'm going to say that he was a very special person. He dedicated a significant portion of his life to Kolovskim et Sorfei Tzibur Be'emuna. He built shuls and other institutions, both in the States and in Israel after he made Aliyah. Unique in that I think there are very few people that I know of that made the decision to come on Aliyah with their family without ever having been to Israel.
Really? What year was that?
1970 was the decision. Mm-hmm. He made a pilot trip in January with my mother, bought an apartment and ordered a car, and in June we were here.
Wow.
That's the only one here that actually knew Howie's father.
Right.
Although I didn't know his name was Yisrael, I always knew him as Irving, but okay.
Irving. Yeah.
Okay. Where was he from?
He was born in the States, grew up in Brooklyn, East New York, Brownsville.
Mm-hmm. Yay!
Okay, well, he should, and tonight you have a yard site.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, so Le'ilui Nishmato. We are back in the Mishnah. You remember that in this perek, all the Mishnah is front-ended. So here's the Mishnah that we're looking at. This is in the third perek. It's the fourth Mishnah, but like I said, all of the Mishnayot are listed up front. The Mishnah says, Ezehu Dever. What is a plague of dever, of I think it's usually called in English pestilence. I'm not sure what that is, but you don't want to get it, right? It's a kind of disease where people die. Now, it happens that this is all quite relevant to our ongoing situation of coronavirus. So if there's a dever, so you have to have, you initiate the fasting in response to dever, just like you initiate fasting in response to drought. Dever is another category of a sign of calamity. Previously in the Mishnah, we had talked about mapolet, right? A building collapse. That was based on the building collapse. We had that string of agadot that all have somehow, however tangentially, the wall collapsing, the building collapsing, the merits of the people. The people knew whose merits the building doesn't collapse, etc. But now the Mishnah moves on to the topic of pestilence, dever. Ir hamotzia chamesh ma'ot ragli, a town which is big enough to muster an armed force of 500 ragli. Now I'm going to translate ragli as foot soldier. Right? Meaning that there are 500 men of serviceable age, not women, not children, not elderly, who could be called up for the draft at need in the defense of the city. V'yatzu mimenu shlosha metim b'shlosha yamim. And three people of this population, three people die over the course of 3 days, ze achar ze, 3 days in a row, hare ze dever. That is a sign of dever. It doesn't mean that somebody dies because they fell off a roof. But three people that die of some, otherwise unattributable cause, that in a population this size, that's dever. Pachot mikan, ain't a dever. And less than that, that is not considered a dever. Now, Yehudi, we missed you last week.
I know, I've told you.
But I'm still allowed to say that we missed you. You had internet problems. act of God. But it's, you know, it's not the same without you. But I got from you this week. I got from you this week a whole variety of links to texts and other things because you do your homework. But I don't always have time to look over your homework in the minutes before the class from the time you sent it to me a half hour ago until now. So you sent me a whole variety of things related to Ragli. Now, what was your point there?
But just to make sure, you know, I was agreeing with you, but the issue here to me is what happens if three women drop dead? You see, that's the thing that basically struck me as being weird.
Oh, no, but it's not, in other words, three people die. Chamesh Mot Ragli is just an identifier of the size of the population. We're talking here, of course, about statistics. You know, like we've all been, what's that number they keep talking about, the R number? Am I misremembering that? The R number is it's the ratio of how many people in the population contract corona. Is that what that is?
I'm not following it.
How many spread from one to the next? In other words, if one person gets it, how quickly it will spread, how the ratio of it spreads from
and R one is, person. R is just ratio.
I think so.
Right. So in other words, to say that X number of people in your town have corona or have Dever is only relevant if you know. It's only a meaningful statistic if you know how many people you're talking about. Right. In other words, every death is terrible. Every life is precious. Each person, each human is olam umlo'ah. Right. And the death of each person is more like the death of an entire world. But that's not speaking epidemiologically. That's speaking philosophically, theologically. Epidemiology, if one person dies, how many people die a day in Manhattan? Probably quite a few. I'm not talking about murder. I'm just the natural circle of life. A certain amount of people are going to die because you're dealing, to begin with a very large population. How many people die a day in our little town of Efrat? Less than, on average, less than one. Right? But it's only meaningful, right? It's only meaningful if you know the size of the population you're dealing with. So Chamesh Mot Ragli has nothing to do with the military, per se. It has to do, it's an indicator of a population size. Why the Gemara chooses, instead of saying a town that has X number of human souls, I don't know. But apparently this
was... That was the point of what I was saying.
Yeah, so apparently this is a...
The place where this was coming from was David's census.
Oh, so hold on a second. Yehudi, hold on. I'm going to come to that momentarily. But now there's apparently Chamesh Mot Ragli is a statistical metaphor for the size of a certain town. And the number that there should be a death a day for 3 days running in a town that size is a sign of Dever. So now you sent to me the idea, but the deaths are not the deaths of the foot soldiers per se, the deaths of anyone, man, woman, or child. Now you wanted to suggest that based on Shmuel Bet, Perek 24, chapter 24 in Shmuel Bet, that is a source for this idea of 3 days, that it's taking place consecutively over 3 days. Now, what are the numbers there again? Refresh my memory.
Well, there are 1,300,000 soldiers, fighting men, all together from a whole census. And then when the plague comes, 70,000 men die.
Right.
So I did it. Anyone who's better at some math than I am could probably do better with this than I did. But it was one thing clear. The idea of a three-day period, 3 days running, that seems to be coming right out of that story in Shmuel Bet.
Perhaps.
Because that's how long the plague lasts, 3 days.
Right.
And basically, in other words, if you go 23,000 and so a day, the ratio is not that much different from 1 or 500. Now, with the United States right now, the other day, just 2 days ago, I think 3,000 people died out of a population, more than that actually, out of a population of 330 million.
Right, so that's a lot less. So
And always, what I'm saying here is, from the Tanakh point of view, I think that Mishnah got the idea from the story into two small bets. David's given three choices.
Of course, the context in Shmuel Bet is David counts the people, which is prescribed.
Counts
the soldiers, right? But since this idea of counting individuals is taboo in our culture, in our faith, so David interprets the plague as being punishment for that offense. Which, by the way, might be how we get this kind of odd statistical metaphor. Instead of saying any town that has, I don't know, 5,000 people, right? That X number of people die out of a population of 5,000. So that itself might be a residue of the taboo against counting people, since we don't count people. So therefore, we don't even give the the population statistics in whole numbers.
Could it be that the 500 infantrymen were just simply a sign of the healthier people in the community, and therefore they were if they were the ones who were dropping dead, then obviously that's
no, but they're not the ones that are dropping dead. In other words,
that was the whole point of what I started with.
Yeah, the Mishnah says any city that's large enough to muster, in other words, each city would have, like we have here, we have the Mishmar Ezrachi, right? So in other words, how many, Efrat does not have enough citizens to have 500 people on the Mishmar Ezrachi, right? We're just not that big. So in other words, any town that's big enough to have...
For the American listener here, could you explain what you just said?
Oh, there's in a lot of yeshuvim, they have kind of like a citizens patrol. People that are trained in advanced security, the home guard, right?
Okay.
People that they give backup security around town at need. So any town, a town that has a Mishmar Ezrachi of 500 people, let's say, that would be a certain proportion of their overall population. If three people, but not necessarily three of those soldiers, maybe yes, maybe no, it could be women, it could be children, it could be old people, right? If there are three deaths ascribed to the Dever in over 3 days, so then you start fasting. So now...
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm following in the translation in Sfaria, and it gives different numbers. I don't know. Are you read...
So I read from the Mishnah from two pages earlier. So now here, now we're turning to the Gemara where you are.
Okay.
Right? So the Gemara says Tanu Rabbanan. There's a Braisa. The Braisa is parallel, but it's different. It gives different numbers. The numbers are all the same, but the ratio is the same. Just the numbers are different, right? So Tanu Rabbanan. Ir Hamotzia Chamesh Maot VeElef Ragli. A town that has 1,500, meaning it's three times larger than the town in the Mishnah, Kigon, Kfar Akko. And the Brisa mentions a particular place that at the time that Brisa had such a population, V'yotzu hemenu tisha meitim b'shlosha yamim ze achar ze hare ze dever. And they have nine people that die over 3 days, meaning three a day, presumably. That's Dever. So does the Braisa and the Mishnah agree on the essential ratio of how many deaths you need to have as a proportion of your population? 500, 3 out of 500, or 9 out of 1,500? Hare ze Dever. Biyom echad o ba'arba yamim ein ze Dever. But if all of those people, let's go back to the case in the Mishnah, right? If three people die all on the same day, right? Or they die over 4 days, that's not Dever. Dever means that in a population the size, one person dies a day for 3 days running. In a population of 1,500 soldiers, three people die a day for 3 days running, a total of nine. But if one person dies today, and two people die tomorrow, and nobody dies the third day, that's not Dever. What would...
interesting, the Yerushalmi starts discussing about whether or not it would be considered Dever if two people drop dead of quote-unquote Dever, and then somebody else dies of...
something else.
What do they call it? Ashkara.
Yeah.
In other words, the way Yerushalmi talks about it, it sounds a lot different than what we're... Yep. What do you really mean by Dever? That's another thing. I said to a searcher that also. Because how the word's used in Tanakh and how it's used in the Mishnah. In other words, in English, it's usually translated pestilence. Right. But the scholars generally translate it bubonic plague.
Really? I mean...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Plague.
The bubonic plague specifically, or...?
Well, I actually discussed the transmission that I have on my software, a program called Ancient Medicine. But most of the standard lexicons translated as bubonic plague. Now, however, in the translation itself, they use the word pestilence.
Right. I can't imagine it means specifically the bubonic plague and not some other plague or not some other.
Because what are we thinking about here?
I mean, cholera? Cholera.
Well, okay, but cholera will be fine too, but what I'm getting at is, are we clearly talking about an infectious disease? That's the first question.
Well, from the continuation of our Gemara...
They knew the cholera was infectious. They knew plague was. I don't think they knew the croup was. Croup is the period.
Right.
You know, in other words, that's what we call Ashkara.
Right.
I'm not so sure they were aware of the fact that that was transmitted from person to person.
Right.
But what I'm getting at is, when we're talking about Dever, do we mean an infectious disease of some kind? Because obviously when the Dever occurs to David's soldiers, that's not what we're talking about. So what are we talking about? When the Dever occurs in Egypt for one day and everybody drops dead, one, two, three, what exactly are we speaking
that
about?
That does not sound like an infectious disease.
Well, I sent you a search.
Yeah, so in Chazal, in other words, in Sefer Shmuel, in Sefer Shmot, Dever seems to be some kind of divine makkah.
And then also, in Masechet Avot, Dever Baal Yoma, this is that.
Right, so in Chazal... Yeah, so in Chazal, certainly here amongst the Bavli Amoroyim, it seems that they understand it to be some kind of infectious disease.
Okay.
And we'll see momentarily, we're talking...
Is that related to the fact that lots of people show up in one place? Some of the lists that they have there don't relate to that.
Yehudi, let me move on now for a moment,
okay,
but we're gonna come back to this momentarily.
Okay,
so then the Gemara goes on. Biyom echad o ba'arba yamim ein zedever ve'ir hamotzia chamesh mot ragli kegon kfar amiko v'yatzu hemenu shlosha metim b'shlosha yamim ze achar ze hare ze dever. So that's the end of the Braita, which that part corresponds with our Mishnah, except for the fact that the Braita mentions a particular location, Kfar Amiko. Earlier, first the Braita mentions Akko, or Kfar Akko, and now Kfar Amiko. Amiko might be Amuka, the town in the Galil Elyon, where you have the Kever of Yonasan Ben Uziel. Where people go because of all the skulot, and you get a shidduch and all those other good things. So that according to many, that's what I tried to figure. I'd never heard of Amiko. So apparently, Amiko is Amuka in the Galil Elyon. It's called Amuka because it has a baka. It has like a valley, an amok. So the Gemara here at the top of Kaf Aleph Amud Beis, it just continues. If it's spread out over more days or if it's more concentrated, it's not different. Now the Gemara says, Drokart. Drokart's the name of a place in Bavel. I did not succeed in looking to see where that is. Drokart ir hamotzia chamesh mod ragli hava. Drokart was a town of this size, exactly the size of the Mishnah. V'yatsu memenu shlosha meitim biyom echad. and three people drop dead on one day. So according to what we saw in the Mishnah in the Braisa, is that Dever or is that not Dever? Not Dever, because it was all on one day instead of one over, it was three on one day instead of one a day for 3 days running. But nevertheless, Gazar Rav Nachman bar Rav Chisda Tanita. Rav Nachman bar Rav Chisda said, oh, we should have a Tanit. And as he was Machmir, he according to the letter of the Mishnah, you don't need to have a Tanit if it's all on one day. So Omar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak Kiman Kerebi Meir. According to whose opinion is he being stringent to on the first day when three people die on one day, instead of waiting 3 days to see if you have this pattern? So he says, I am following the opinion of Rebbe Meir. In which context is he following the opinion of Rebbe Meir? This is the beauty of Chazal. The ability to take two apparently completely unrelated areas of life and law and to extrapolate from one to the other. He says, we can learn from the shor shanogach, the ox who gores. It happens to be Parshas HaShavua. You know, this week is Parshat Mishpatim. I spent 1 year on the faculty of Yeshivat Or Yerushalayim, a yeshiva that doesn't really exist, but was around for many years, and many boys from America came and studied in Or Yerushalayim in Beit Meir. So in Or Yerushalayim, they had a very old minhag when I got there, that even though, you know, usually you come to yeshiva, it's all Torah Lishma, there's no tests. But there was once a year a test. And Parshat Mishpatim, this week, I remember that week it was also bitterly cold and rainy, as it is this week. On Parshat Mishpatim, at the end of the week, the boys are all examined. They get a test on the Rashis on Parshat Mishpatim. Because the Rosh Yeshiva thought that if you don't know all the Rashis on Parshat Mishpatim, there's no chance you'll be a Talmid Chacham. Knowing the Rashis on Parshat Mishpatim doesn't automatically make you a Talmid Chacham. But without them, you don't stand a shot. Because the Rashis on Parshat Mishpatim are the cliff notes to all of Seder Nezikin. Right? If you know the Rashis on Mishpatim, it's the perfect overview of much of Seder Nezikin and lots of other parts of the Torah Shiba Al Peh. So I often recommend to people, you know, even people who aren't careful to read the Rashi's every week, for Parshas Mishpatim, you should be careful.
I think one of the Babas we were learning in the Shir, and you had us
read
the relevant Rashi's.
Yeah, but I didn't give you the test. I have
it. Imagine what we would have been if we had.
I kept a copy of that test. It was the same test. They just reused it every year in the yeshiva. I found a copy of it not long ago. It's like on an old mimeograph. I have it tucked away somewhere. I forget where it is. But maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll have an examination to see. So how did Rav Nachman bar Chisda think that you should have a fast after the first day when three people die? So that's the case of the Shor Shanogach. Rabbi Meir said, Richek negichatav chayav. Kirev negichotav lo kol shechen. What's the halacha of the Shor Shanogach? An ox who gores, who pierces a person with his horns. If he does it three times, he's considered a shor mu'ad. He's muhzak. He. It's well known that this is a dangerous ox. And if he is such an ox, the owners of the ox carry an additional responsibility to make sure that he doesn't cause bodily or property harm to others. And if he does, then the negligent owner of the ox has a higher level of responsibility. So what makes, you know, like if you have a dog, like here in the neighborhood, there are a lot of people with dogs. There are people that walk their dogs on leashes like you're supposed to. There are people that let their dogs run around wild like you're not supposed to. There are people that clean up after their dogs like you're supposed to. There are people that don't clean up after their dogs, right? And there's some people that go, they have a muzzle on their dog when they're walking them. Because if you have a dog that's known to bite, and it bites, you know, I don't know, your neighbor's kid, it's a terrible thing. So you have to if you know that your dog is potentially going to take a nip out of a passerby, you have a higher responsibility to make sure that doesn't happen. So Rabbi Meir says, the owner of the ox has to pay full damages if the nigiha, the goring, took place three times over a couple of days. But if the ox gores three times on the same day, lo kol shekain, kal v'chomer. Right? So in other words, I said, what are you telling me? He says, what's our response to Defer? We have to fast. We have to do tshuva. Right? So if three people die, you have to do tshuva. So you want to say if they die over the course of 3 days, that's a sign things are bad. But if three people drop dead on the first day, boy, gewalt, how bad is it going to be the second day? So that is the kol shekain, that is the kol shekain that Rabbi Meir learned from which Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak said, we should be more stringent than the halacha and the mishnah, and if three people die on one day, we should start fasting. So Omer le Rav Nachman Bar Rav Chizda le Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. So it's confusing because they have similar names. Nachman Bar Chizda says to Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, he says, oh, that was a good halacha you said. He identifies his friend Bar Yitzchak, Bar Chizda, says the Bar Yitzchak, that was pretty good. Lekom mar leite legaban. Why don't you get up and come and be with us? Apparently, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak lived in a place where his Talmudic brilliance was not appreciated. So Rav Nachman Bar Chizda invited him to come to his town to be amongst the Talmidei Chachamim that would, appreciate his brilliance. So Amar Lei, Bar Yitzchak responds, Taneina, it's a Braisa. The Braisa teaches, Rav Yossi Omer, Lo Mikomo Shel Adam Mechabdo, Ela Adam Mechabed Et Mikomo. No? The place doesn't honor the man honors the place. Meaning, the town that I'm in, they don't show me kavod. They don't respect my Torah learning, right? But that's not the point. The point is the man honors the place, not the place honoring the man. Shekein matzinu bahar Sinai, shekol zman sheshchina shruya alav, amra Torah, gam hatzon v'bakar al yiru el mul ha'arahu. What was the point of at Har Sinai? Har Sinai has no inherent kedusha. It was only kadosh, and it was forbidden for the animals to graze upon it while the Shekhinah was present. When God was present, it brought honor to the mountain, and the mountain had to be treated with extra respect. But once Nistalkash Shekhinah Mimenu, once God's holy presence departs from Sinai, Amra Torah, Bimshoch Hayovel Hema Ya'alu Bahar. But once the shofar blows at the end of Matan Torah and the Shekhinah departs, so then anybody can go up to the mountaintop. Now there's the sanctity of Har Sinai was because of the presence of God. But there's no inherent There's nothing inherent. So Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak was saying, look, you know, I might come to your town, but that's not the point. I'm not guaranteed more kavod in your town than I am in my town, where I don't get a lot of it. Now, here it's a brisa, but I would have said, were it not a brisa, I would have said this well-known vort about Har Sinai was actually a favorite of Rabbi Soloveitchik, who used to point out that it's contradicted by Har HaMoriah. In other words, the point of Har Sinai is that there's nothing, and as a matter of fact, historically, we don't even know where Har Sinai is. I mean, if you go down to Midbar Sinai, you'll find a tour guide that will take you someplace and point and say, that's Har Sinai, that's Mount Sinai. But it is a curiosity that we did not preserve the location of Har Sinai. You'd think that's a pretty significant event in Jewish history. And people would like to know where it is. And if you're on a tiul, you might want to see it. You would think somebody would put up a sign or sell Arktikim and souvenirs at its base. There are other mountains in Jewish history that have succeeded in doing that. Ayin Masada, Har HaMoria, although, you know, going up to it is debatable. But the fact that it's become a tourist attraction is definitely not. Har HaKarmel, right? There are a lot of mountains that we make a whole big deal out of, but not Har Sinai. So Rabbi Soloveitchik makes his point that...
The Goyim do. They've got a monastery. What you call it?
Yeah, so there is a monastery. But in other words, we don't hold that that's necessarily the historical Sinai. Right? Yeah, that I'm talking here from the Jewish point of view. The Jewish point of view that even if we knew... Even if we had absolute historical, archaeological tradition evidence of exactly where Har Sinai is, there would be no problem going playing racquetball there. Because there's no inherent Kedusha on Har Sinai. The sanctity of Sinai was momentarily, while God was present giving the... But Har Moria, which... contradicts the point of Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Har HaMoria, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the site of the Beit HaMikdash, even in its destruction, maintains eternal sanctity, which is why it's difficult to go there. Halachically, even the people that go up to Har HaBayit go up to the part of Har HaBayit which was added on, which was not part of the original Beit HaMikdash, meaning Jews who are careful about the halacha, who go up to Har HaBayit, often, with some religious combined with some political energy, but they don't go to where the Mikdash was. They don't stand certainly not in the place where the Kodesh HaKadoshim was, which is now underneath the Kippat HaSela, because that maintains eternal sanctity. And Rabbi Soloveitchik's point was that it all has to do with the direction. On Har Sinai, God came down to us in order to deliver the Torah. So when that happened, it creates sanctity for the moment, but not eternal sanctity. On Har HaMoria, through our worship, at Har Sinai, the Jewish people were passive, right? We were recipients, but at Har HaMoria, we were active. We initiated the service of God, and that creates eternal sanctity. At Har Sinai, God came down. At Har HaMoria, the people ascend, as it were. And that's the difference between the two things. All right, that was parenthetical. V'chein matzinu be'oel moed shebamidbar shekol zman shehu natui at the oel moed, in the mishkan, not the mikdash, but the mishkan, as long as the tent was erected, amrat Torah, v'yishalchu min hamachane kol tsarua. Nobody who was tamei with tsara'at could even be in the encampment while the mishkan was at the center. Why? Because God's presence was there on the Mishkan. Huglalu haparochet. But when they folded up the tent, when they packed it up in order to put it on the wagons, when the encampment was moving, hutru zavin mitzoraim likanes sham. So all of the tmeim could rejoin the camp when the Mishkan was closed for business because it was folded up and on its way. So Omar le Ihochi, so Rav Nachman bar Rav Chisda says to Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, so if that's true, if you don't wanna come, Nekem Ana Lagabe Mar. So I will leave my town of Talmidei Chachamim to come to your town of people that don't appreciate Talmidei Chachamim so that I can learn Torah from you. So Omar Le, Mutav Yavo Mana Ben Pras, Etzel Mana Ben Mana. A mana is a 100 dinar. It's a weight of gold. It's a weight of currency. Right? It's worth 100 dinar. So it's like saying, no, a $50 bill, a pras means chetzi, right? That's 50 dinar. So a $50 bill should go to the $100 bill, and the $100 bill should not come to the $50 bill. This is a meaning someone of greater value should not be troubled to come to someone of lesser value. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak was modest. He said, no, you shouldn't come to me. You shouldn't schlep to me. I should schlep to you. Valyavo mana ben mana, it's a mana ben pras.
Steindl seems to indicate here that it's talking about their fathers.
Yes, so that's the mana ben mana versus the mana ben pras. Each of us, we're both 100. I mean, maybe we're Talmidei Chachamim of equal measure. We're each a mana. We're each 100. But you, Rav Nachman Bar Rav, you Rav Nachman Bar Rav Chisda, you are a mana ben mana. You are a righteous scholar, the son of a righteous scholar. And I am a mana ben pras. I am the righteous scholar, the son of an ordinary man. Right, so all together, you and your father together, you're worth 200, and me and my father together, we're only worth 150. So, meaning it's a weird metaphor. It's, you know, like the idea of a tzaddik ben tzaddik and a tzaddik ben rasha. Right, ultimately everyone is measured on their own merits and their own values, but at the same time we factor in this idea of schut avot, right, of yichus, of you come from good stock, that counts for something. So Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says, no, I shouldn't make you schlep because you are the son of Rav Chisda. So I'll come to you. All right, that's the end of that story. Besura.
Can we say now something about this? You're starting something new. I want to comment on what you just said.
Yes, please.
Okay. This whole bit about Lo Makom Shalda Machab, though, the proof it's being used for, it doesn't really relate to the issue that's at hand. Mm-hmm. In other words, what we're talking about here is a person who's basically doesn't want to move because of the fact that he's not going to get that much kavod, exactly the opposite of what Jesus says, which is a prophet is without honor in his own country. But either way, the proof that you from Har Sinai doesn't prove anything as far as that's concerned. You know, it's just a cute drash, but it doesn't really prove the point. I would think you might do better if you talk about the four holy cities and say for Bereshit, which, by the way, Yerushalayim is not one of them. And number two, we have absolutely no idea where Eretz HaMoriah really is. The first attempt to locate it is in Divrei Hayamim, which is obviously a drash. You know, what do you call that? Inner biblical midrash. There's nothing in the Tanakh itself that makes you think that at the time of the Avot, Yerushalayim was a holy city. A holy city was where the Avot erected Mizbechot by Yikra B'Shem Hashem. That was a holy city. And the four of them are Shechem, Bekel, Hebron, and Be'er Sheva. Now, those four cities brought Kavod to their inhabitants throughout the entire period of the Tanakh. Well, to the Korban anyway. Okay, well, I take that back. To the Korban. They were always looked upon as cities of greater importance than Stam cities. You know, they may not have been important as Jerusalem, but making Jerusalem as important is completely David's doing. In the end of Sefer Shoftim, there's a story about a person, those two people in Pelegish Megillah. Somebody proposes, let's sleep over in Yerushalayim. And the other guy says, are you kidding me? Sleep there? That's Sin City. I wouldn't be caught dead there. So It's very clear. Nobody thought of Yerushalayim as anything desirable until David made it desirable, Whereas the four cities that are associated with Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, they retain their title right smack to the Purim.
Okay.
And there I would say maybe what he's trying to say is that the city, you know, what we're not getting here, and I'm not saying, you know, we can access this information, but what I'm saying is it would sort of be nice to know about the two cities we're talking about, how they were objectively seen at the time, you know, by the residents who live there and by the population as a whole, in order to flesh this story out a little bit better, okay? Because, the Har Sinai thing is really cute. It's a great trash, but it in no way fleshes out what's going on with the story, okay? It's just a great dress attached to a story, okay? It doesn't help us.
I mean, I don't think, do we know where Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak was from?
That's what I'm saying. I'm going to try to do some work on it and email it to you. But all I'm saying is that it doesn't change the fundamental thing here, that what Rabbi Soloveitchik said has absolutely nothing to do with what's going on here.
Well, no, okay, and it was in a different. To be clear, that was in a completely different context. The our Gemara doesn't speak at all of.
Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying it's just dead wrong. Yerushalayim was not one of any place of consequence.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Once the Mikdash is built, so then
that's when it becomes important.
And that's exactly his point. But that's exactly his point.
No, he's saying Eretz HaMoriah is where it was.
No, he didn't. He said Har HaMoriah versus Har Sinai. By Har HaMoriah, he meant the Temple Mount. He meant the place of Mokom HaMikdash.
I get it.
Right? Poetically, he was speaking of Har HaMoriah, meaning Mokom HaMikdash, as contrast to the Har Sinai.
I wanted to say for Bereshit Dafka.
No. It's true that the Midrash imagines Har HaMoriah of the Akedah being Mokom HaMikdash, right? But his point had nothing to do with the Akedah. It had to do with the Mokom HaMikdash and the Korbanot of.
That's all Drash.
Okay, and as is the Gemara here. Okay. No. Okay. Let me go.
By the way, just one thing you asked about where Nachum Bar Chizkiya was from. So he was from Jokart, right? That's what the Gemara says.
Oh. No, that was Rav Nachum Bar Chizkiya. But where was Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak?
No, you asked where either one was from.
He was from Jokart. But where was the place of little respect? That I'm not sure where that is. Okay, let's go on. Besura, the Gemara goes on. Besura havat dvarta. There was a dever, there was a plague in Sura. Beshivavute derav lo havet dvarta. But in the neighborhood of Rav lived in Sura. In Sura, which was a big city, there was a plague. But in Rav's neighborhood of Sura, there was no plague. So how could that be? Savru mine mishum schuta de Rav. So the people assumed that it was in the merits of Rav, that Rav kept the plague away because of his righteousness. It chazilahu bechelma. So they were visited by a dream, I guess meaning the townspeople of Rav's neighborhood were visited by a dream. Rav, dinefisha schuta tuva, Ha milta zutra le l'rav. And in the dream, they're informed that Rav's merit is so great that he can't be bothered with such a small thing. Meaning, it's true that Rav has great merits, but the presence of this plague not coming to that neighborhood had nothing to do with Rav's merits. Ella, mishum hahu gavra. But because of a different person in the neighborhood, that man, deshayel mora uzvila lekvura. There was one guy in the neighborhood, and he had a shovel and what do you call that thing that you dig with? No?
A spade.
Okay. Two synonyms for digging tools, whatever they are, a spade and a shovel. And he used to lend them to the Chevra Kadisha, who needed it to bury people. So it was this guy. It's an interesting idea, which is paralleled in the next line as well, that, you know, sometimes you look at a place and you say, oh, that great rabbi, it's all in his merit. But no, maybe look at the small person. Maybe look at the simple person. Maybe think that the community together is doing well, not because of the great holy rabbi that's there, but because of, you know, the simple guy that lends out his shovel when the Chevra Kadisha, Rachmana Litzlan, needs to bury. So it's that person who does a rather simple act of kindness. And that's what sustains the town. The Gemara tells another parallel story. How do you pronounce this word? Drukart Havat Dleikta. There was a fire. You know, like in those days, I mean, we all remember these. Like, we don't live in a time where this happens so much anymore. We have earthquakes, we have plagues. God knows we're in the middle of one. But, you know, like the San Francisco fire or the Chicago fire or things like that, where a whole city would burn down, we don't see that much anymore. Now, the idea that Mrs. O'Leary's cow can knock over a lantern in the barn and all of Chicago goes up in smoke, that's not something that we experience, at least not in the Western world. But that was a terrible thing.
We had that in Moshav Matityahu.
In Matityahu, yeah, they had. But that was that. Yeah, yeah. But that was because of the wildfires. Like they had in Tzur Hadassah also last summer. Oh yeah, and the truth is, in California they have these wildfires. Yeah, so wildfires are different. It's true. Okay, I take back what I said. So there was a dleika in Drukart, but in Rav Huna's neighborhood there was no fire. The fire didn't reach that corner. Savur mi neibeschuta de Rav Huna, so they assumed that his neighborhood was spared in the merits of Rav Huna. Dinofish, it was spared. It chazeluhu bechelma, and similarly, the residents of the neighborhood had a dream. This idea of like a kind of communal dream is very interesting. There's probably more to be said about that. Hai zutrele le Rav Huna ela mishum dahi itata de mechamamat tanura. No, it wasn't Rav Huna's merit that protected the neighborhood. It was that old babi. There was an old lady, and what would she do? She would heat up her oven. Because, you know, you always have a neighbor who needs the oven. Like, you know, like there were times where there were communal ovens. You know, that was like the story about the chont pots. You know the story about the chillin pots? In other words, in Europe, there were communal ovens. And people would bring their chillin pot and put it in. They would heat up the oven very, very, very hot before Shabbat. People would put their chillin in the communal oven. You know, like think of like the pizza ovens that we have. And the fire would go for however long it would go. It would burn out at a certain point. It would stay warm until Shabbos morning. And Shabbos morning, after davening, you'd go, you'd pick up your chillin pot from the communal bakery and take it home. But people would take the chillin pots. They were like probably a ceramic pots with a lid. And people would tie the lid of their pot. You ever see this? You ever see such a thing? Right? And every family had a different, distinct way of tying its pot, which would both serve as the marker that was their pot, but it served as a kind of seal, if the yarn or the thread that was used to tie up the pot to the handles, so that nobody would come and take your piece of flunken out of your chillin pot. You know, take a you know, like the yeshiva guys always like to have chillin on Friday night. Right. So oven space is always precious. Like we often have on Friday, we have a small oven. When we got married, we were Israeli. We got a small washing machine, a small oven, but our neighbors, they came on Aliyah with their stuff. So they have a big American size oven. So on Friday afternoon, like, you know, at a certain point you do the math and you realize there is no way that all the things that have to get cooked in this house are going to have enough time in the oven before Shabbat. So we're constantly going next door to the crones and putting stuff in their oven, right? And Friday, and it happened this Friday afternoon. We weren't really doing any cooking, but our neighbor upstairs, her oven broke. So she put onto the building WhatsApp list, does anybody have space in their oven? I have this cake that's raw, but my oven isn't working, and I need to cook it before Shabbos. So that's a great chesed. That's a great chesed. So in Drukart, there was an old woman. She would keep her oven going all the time because she knew there was always a neighbor that needed help. And it was in her merit that the fire didn't get to her town. Now you see, obviously, again, this idea of the simple person whose merit, is the true salvation of the town. But you see that their actions are, you see the symbolism in the Agadah. In the first case, you have the Dever. The Dever, people are dropping dead, they have to be buried, right? What was his merit? He used to lend out the shovel to the Chevra Kadisha. And in the merit of lending out the shovel to the Chevra Kadisha, the people in his neighborhood did not die of the Dever. In the second case, there's a fire rages through town. In the merit of the fire she kept burning in her oven, her neighborhood was spared. Okay, I think we have to end there before we get to the locusts and other terrible things. And we will continue next week. Stay warm and dry in the snow. And again, tonight we were learning Le'iloi Nishmas Rabbi Yisrael ben Pesach Zichrono Levracha and Maizel's Tzvi's father. Amen. And Tzvi will be coming around to each of our homes with a bottle. And otherwise, in what way could a neshama possibly have an aliyah?
It will be my pleasure.
Okay. Bye.